speakers did for questions to be at the end. I might ask you questions during the session, but for your questions, I'm going to ask you to hold to the end, and I'm glad to discuss them during lunch. I want to thank Serena and David Koshitsky for dedicating our program today in memory of Riva Koshitsky, Zichrona Livracha. And for this session is dedicated by Fran and David Wolf and family in commemoration of the Yahrzeit on the third day of Hanukkah of David's father, Sidney Wolf, Zichrona Livracha, Shimon ben Yitzchak Gershom. Shema should have an aliyah. Thank you for dedicating it. And our topic is the ban on intermarriage. Is it racist? So, you know, we've been trying to move along with Hanach so far today, and that's the way we structured the sessions. This session is the last one that's going to be a Chumash session, and then we'll get to the Nach part of it after lunch. This session is anchored in particular in the seventh chapter of Devarim. If you take a look on the sheet, you can see we're on page 14 in the packet. Source number one. When Hashem your God brings you into the land to which you are arriving to settle it, He will collapse many nations before you. Hittite, Girgashite, Amorite, Canaanite, Perizzite, Hivite, and Yebusite. I don't know if they actually added the ites. I put in the ites when I did the translation. Seven nations that are greater and mightier than you, dot, 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 you shall not marry among them. Your daughter you shall not give to his son. His daughter you shall not take for your son, for he will lead your son away from me, and they will serve foreign gods. That is one of several examples in Tanakh where we are warned about marrying into the nations around us. And my question is this a racist statement? You can't marry anybody from them. Now, taking a minute just to define racism as I'm using it, because it's a term itself that requires definition. Racism is, first of all, race is usually a social construct. It's not an objective identity. So when you talk about ethnicity and being a descendant of certain people, you have to recognize that within certain cultures, they will subdivide what you might think of as a standard ethnicity into multiple races. So as an example, I taught a session on the issue of racism in Judaism a few years ago, and somebody at the session said to me that in Brazil, they distinguish as separate races between people who are of darker skin or of lighter skin, even when they're from the same ethnic heritage. Fundamentally, it's really more something that, it's a term that we invent, as a construct that may be based on what country people are from, and maybe based on genealogy. It makes use of, data, but it's not itself data driven. It's based on the terms that society chooses to put. I actually gave you a piece on this in source number two. Did race and racism exist in the Middle Ages, from Professor Geraldine Hain? Race is one of the primary names we have for our repeating tendency to demarcate human beings through selected differences that are identified as absolute and fundamental. And the goal is, as she puts it, to distribute power differentially to human groups, to distinguish between different groups. I'm jumping, though, from the question of what is a race to the question of what is racism. And there, I would contend that racism is judgment of an individual member of a race based on traits, positive or negative, that are assumed to belong to the race as a whole. So-and-so is Persian, therefore the following thing is true about them. So-and-so is Polish, therefore such-and-such is true about them. That's my definition that I'm working with for racism. We generally assume that that's a degrading thing to do, right? Associating negative traits with somebody, or even positive traits. You know, even if people say, I'll pick Jews, even if people say that Jews are hardworking, or Jews are this, or Jews are that, in the most positive of ways, who wants to really be typed based on an assumption about a population? We like to be viewed as individuals. So that's just defining the term racism here. And what I want to talk about in our share is specifically a negative ethnic racism which says that some human beings are less than others, such that a Jew shouldn't marry them. And at first glance, I would look at Judaism and say that's entirely unacceptable. I would look at Judaism and say, no, there's no way one should be allowed to do that. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 3, and God created his image, in the image created by God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Leave aside the two creations of Adam and Eve and whether they were created simultaneously or sequentially, that's not our function right now. But rather, the fact that we are told that human beings are created in the image of God, all of us, with that image, that really should end the question about attributing negative traits to somebody by default. And I brought you a couple of quotes here in source number 4 and source number 5. Rabbi Shimon Sofer, writing in Hungary in the 19th century, says it's obvious that from when our sages said that the dignity of creatures is great, overriding a biblical prohibition, he's quoting a Gemara in Brachos, and it says, brios is the term in Hebrew, briot. The general term creatures, he said, obviously it includes non-Jews as well. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in source number 5 says explicitly, from the standpoint of the Torah, there can be no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race or color. Any discrimination shown to a human being on account of the color of his or her skin constitutes loathsome barbarity. He's not leaving it up for question or nuance. I heard Rav Aaron Soloveitchik live many times, and that's the way he would speak. You have a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, going back to Talmudic times in source number 6, which says that Hashem creates human beings starting with one individual. When he creates the animals, he starts with many, many, many pairs. When it comes to human beings, Hashem starts with one individual. Why? So that we would understand we all come from one ancestor, and you can't claim that your heritage is greater than somebody else's heritage. And there's so much more that we could say on this, you know, on this front, but we have to get to our problem. Right now, everything I've quoted says one thing. And the problem is that there's another way to view it. And that is the Torah's ban on marrying, for Jews to marry others. We already saw it in source number 1, but take a look at other examples. Take a look at source number 7, where I brought you a collection of verses from different places in Tanakh. Abraham says to his servant, who's going to go find a wife for Yitzchak, he wants him to swear, you will not take a wife for my son from the Canaanite daughters among whom I live. I don't understand. They have an image of God. Why can't he marry somebody from Canaan? Another verse. This is from Sefer Shmos. Lest you take from his daughters for your sons, and his daughters will stray after their gods, they will cause your sons to stray after their gods. Therefore, do not marry among the Canaanites. I'm going to come back to that verse. If you take a look at the top of page 15, this is from the story of Shimshon, of Samson. Samson falls in love with a Philistine woman. He comes to his parents and says, I'd like to marry her. And his father and mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or in my entire nation such that you go take a woman from the uncircumcised Philistines? Why do you have to go find a Plishti? Why do you have to go find a Philistine? Apparently, they're not happy with that. The prophet Malachi, in the beginning of the Second Temple period, criticizes the Jews of his time for taking women from, or both ways, taking husbands and wives from the nations around them. Take a look. Judea has committed treason. An abhorrent thing is done in Israel and Jerusalem, for Judea has desecrated that which was sacred to God, which he loved, mating with the daughter of a foreign god. And actually, Malachi's criticism is specifically the Jewish men marrying non-Jewish women. And then finally, you get from the book of Ezra, also beginning of the Second Temple period. The nobles came to me, Ezra reports in the first person, saying, the nation of Israel and the Kohanim and Levium have not separated from the nations of the lands in their abhorrences, and then you get our list of nations, for they have taken their daughters for them and for their sons, they have mixed the holy progeny among the nations of the lands, and not only that, the nobles and the officials were the ones who were first in doing this, and he tears his clothing, and he pulls out his hair, and he sits on the ground desolate. So, I don't understand. If we're all image of God, why is it that we find verse after verse after verse stating that this is a problem? And I gave you in source number 8 some links to recordings of sessions that I've given on different aspects of the race issue, because we've got a half hour for this, and there's an awful lot more to say in the topic, so you can go to those recordings and listen and yell at me via the computer, because I prefer that. So the simple approach, which I suspect a lot of people are already thinking about because it's the obvious answer, I think, is that the ban is not about race, it's about whether you are part of the covenant or not. Have you accepted the mitzvot or not? Because you see it around Tanakh, that when you marry somebody who does not buy into the bris, does not buy into the covenant, then you run into problems. So Shimshon is a classic example. Shimshon, Samson, marries a Philistine woman, and it causes problems. Not just the one you're thinking of, Delilah. The first one that he marries, there are already problems with. Shimshon is involved with at least two, possibly three Philistine women. If you look early in the Torah, Esav marries Canaanite women, and they are a source of bitterness for Yitzchak and Rivka. On the other hand, as was already mentioned here by Man's Shear, Rut joins us and is the ancestress of David and Mashiach. It's not about where you come from. It's about your commitment to the covenant with God. Yeah, but no. I would have liked to say that. We could have had just like the next 17 minutes just to, you know, talk about that. The problem is that when you go back to some of the verses that I gave you, they specify Canaanites. Right? We said specifically, if you go back to the initial source that I quoted you from Devarim, it was a specific warning about marrying Canaanites. Hittite, Girgashite, Amorite, Canaanite, Perizzite, these are the nations of the land to which you are coming. And in fact, if you look at source number 9, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah has a very strong view that says that the biblical prohibition against marrying out is specifically marrying the Canaanites. It's not about marrying generally someone who is not Jewish. We don't follow that view as a matter of halacha, as a matter of Jewish law. It's understood that the biblical prohibition is in fact outside. But even with that, think about Avraham. We talked about Avraham telling his servant, you want to go get a wife for my son Yitzhak, right? You can't take someone from this land, from the Canaanites. So who is the servant supposed to find? Who's the servant going to bring as a wife for Yitzchak? Well, it's going to be Rivka, but it's supposed to be someone from his family in Aram, an Aramean. The Arameans were not members of the covenant. The family of Betuel and Lavan was idolatrous. We know that. I brought it for you in source number 10. When Lavan makes a pact, right? When Lavan makes his deal with Yaakov, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor shall judge between us. He invokes some kind of separate God. So if you really believe that it's about being part of the covenant or not being part of the covenant, why is it that the prohibition would be Canaan-based? Why are we making such a distinction, right? You understand the problem. Let's make the problem worse, because why not? What is it that Abraham and Sarah spend so much of their time doing? What do we know they do? They convert people, right? They're supposed to be bringing along those around them. Avraham Megayer es HaNashim, Sarah Megayer es HaNashim. They're supposed to be bringing them along. So he's telling them, oh, come, be part of the covenant, but just, you know, we're not going to marry you. Maybe. Is that really how we're supposed to understand it? It's very difficult to understand. And I actually brought you two midrashim in source number 11 and source number 12, which has Avraham specifically say to his servant, I don't want you to marry Yitzchak to the daughters of Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, even though in source number 12 in the Midrash, they are identified as righteous women. The focus on not marrying a Canaanite seems to be more than just they're outside of the covenant. Clear? I'm going fast, but I hope it's still clear. Okay. So, using Canaan as our case study, I think there are things we can learn about the Torah's overall ban on marrying out, aside from covenant concerns. Number one, a very interesting idea, which requires a lot of thought in terms of what we said initially about focusing on race, is the idea of cross-generational family influence, not as a function of biological material, but as part of family practices, what it is that people do and what they teach to their children. When are we first introduced to Canaanites in the Torah? What's the first time we meet a Canaanite? Noah, right? Noah's grandson, Canaan, right? When Noah is intoxicated, Right? Menachem is intoxicated, and you have the whole story, and Shem and Yefet cover him up, but Ham seems to be the one who points out the problem, and Noach, in response to being humiliated as he is, curses Ham's son Kenan, and the Medrash is bothered. I don't understand. Ham was the one who did it, not Kenan, and it suggests that no, as you can read the verses, Kenan is actually involved in the humiliation of Noah when he is intoxicated. And so if you take a look at source number 13, Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra writes in 11th century Spain, when the verse says, Ham is the father of Kenan, both were bad. Why does the Torah say Ham is the father of Kenan? Ham was the father of many people? Because, like father, like son, or as he puts it, as the ancestors do, so the children will do. And this is an idea that we find very powerfully in various Jewish writers over time. I brought you Rabbeinu Nissim in source number 14, who actually makes a very interesting argument, which I'm not sure for the geneticists among us, I'm not sure whether to view this as epigenetics or Lamarckian. Right? Epigenetics being a lot more credible today than Lamarck's genetics. But take a look and you'll see, source number 14, he says, just as one whose heart's blood boils hot must be predisposed to anger, Rabbeinu Nissim, I didn't put it on the sheet, I should have, is writing in 14th century Spain for reference. So he says, just as one whose heart's blood boils hot must be predisposed to anger, so one who is perpetually angry must have his heart's balance heat up and his nature inclined toward anger. Your body, your biology, is going to affect your mood, and your mood will affect your biology, he says. So with all spiritual traits. If so, one who is accustomed to these traits, one who has the anger, let's say, inclines his biological balance and nature to be predisposed to them. Most of the time, the nature of children follows closely the nature of parents. Therefore, the bad traits of Canaanites must continue in their descendants. Laban, he says, is an idolater. That doesn't get passed to your kids. But bad traits, bad character, he says, that's going to go from parent to child, right? For those who don't remember Lamarck from grade school, right, or who were in grade school before Lamarck, so he was the one who said that giraffes get a longer neck because they stretch in order to reach the tree, and then they pass along somehow this trait of having a longer neck to their descendants, which is a remarkable idea. But that's him. But on the other hand, you have the epigenetic idea that you activate certain genes based on your environment, and maybe there's a connection to Rabbeinu Nissim, I don't know, but the idea that he's bringing here is an idea which is popular in Jewish thought in the Middle Ages, which is that what's going on here is you can actually, yes, extrapolate from the traits of a group in terms of the culture that their descendants are going to inherit. You see it a lot in discussions in Judaism about Amalek and why Judaism has such an enmity for Amalek. It also works in the positive. The idea that there will be positive traits. But this is one approach. This is one approach. It's not about the biological material people are made of, it's about the culture that they inherit, and Canaan has a culture, if you think about what we're introduced to in Chumash Bereshit, the culture of Canaan is the culture of Sodom, the culture of Canaan is the culture of Shechem, the culture of Canaan is the culture of Ham and what he does to his father. That's what we are being taught is the neighborhood that is Canaan. So that's one approach. Another approach is to say, it's not about race, but it's about current misbehavior. When the Jews encounter Canaan, Canaan is a bad culture in and of itself. And that is what we're worried about, is the impact of that current behavior, not about ancestry, but who they are today. So Rabbeinu Bechaye says this. I brought it for you in source number 15. Rabbeinu Bechaye, I didn't give you his years either, but he is, I believe, also 14th century Spain. I think he's a student of the Rashbah. So Rabbeinu Bechaye says that regarding Yitzchak not marrying a Canaanite, because the woman who is predisposed for punishment, meaning she acts in a bad way, will lead the man to her side, as did the mother of all who lived. He's talking about Chava. If Yitzchak marries If Yitzchak marries, I'm not going to let any husbands and wives get into this conversation right now about who influenced who. But the idea is that if Yitzchak marries a Canaanite, she is going to lead him into Canaanite conduct. That's why Rabbeinu Bechaye understands this. And it's very interesting, because look at the end of source number 15. He says, therefore the practice has been established in Israel to read this portion for a groom on his wedding day, reminding people to be careful of marriage. On their wedding day, read to them the section about not marrying a Canaanite. Oh boy. A little late at that point, yeah, I don't know what happens. Oh, wait, sorry, can't hold that. I didn't know about this. The Rabbi Ephraim Lunshitz in his Kli Yakar in source number 16 suggests that actually Abraham doesn't want Yitzchak to marry a woman from a bad background and live in the same community. That's the issue, he says. So if he marries a local and he lives in Israel, he's living near his in-laws. That's the problem. So he wants to marry someone from elsewhere and then live locally. That's the way Rabbi Lunshitz in the Kli Yakar, you can see it in number 16, frames the issue. My problem with this approach, and my problem with approach number one as well, is we said that the daughters of Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre are righteous. So now what's your concern? They're righteous. Unless you're going to tell me that it's their family, but Avram was friends with Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. So that's very difficult. So I offer you a third possibility. The third possibility I find fascinating. And that is, it's about our claim to the land of Israel. Yitzchak's marriage begins the process of realizing Hashem's promise to give the land of Israel to the descendants of Abraham and Sarah. And if Yitzchak marries a Canaanite, this is going to warp the bequest in two ways. Then Isaac Abarbanel writes, I brought it for you in source number 17, God promised to give the land to his descendants, to Abram's descendants, the Semites, and to remove the wicked Canaanites therefrom. If Yitzchak would marry a Canaanite woman, the Canaanites would inherit the land. Therefore he prohibited them to him. It's an issue of who is going to end up with Eretz Yisrael. That's the fear, is that the Canaanites would get it that way, or conversely, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, writing in source number 18, a little bit before then Isaac of Abarbanel, suggests the other way around. Which is, it would suggest that the Jewish right to the land came about because they married Canaanites. It would look like our claim to be there is because we married a Canaanite. Therefore, don't let him marry a Canaanite. So in order to avoid Canaanite entanglement, Yitzchak needs to marry somebody from the outside. I thought that was a really interesting approach. So again, to sum up what we've said so far, it's not supposed to be race-based. It's not supposed to be about genetic material. It's about the factors we just mentioned. The influence of a cultural heritage, the influence of current misbehavior, and diluting the claim to Eretz Yisrael. Those are the factors for the Canaanites on top of the general concern about will they be loyal to our covenant. But you have to recognize that there are sources in Judaism that are used to promote a racist approach, right? We have the curse of Canaan and his descendants from Noah. It gets quoted to that effect. And we see the concern for the privilege of the family over the outsider. A quick story from source number 19. The end of Parshas Emor tells the story of the Mekalel or Megadeth. Right? This is somebody who, as the story is told in the Chumash, is a descendant of a Jewish woman and an Egyptian man. And he gets into a fight and he blasphemes. Right? You remember the story? There in the Torah, it's in the end of Parshas Emor. It's a very difficult story to understand. Just the facts of it are difficult to discern from the text. And the Medrash in the Sifra, in source number 19, based on the verses, tells you when the text says he went out, he departed, from where did he depart? From Moshe's court, Moshe's Beis Din. He came to plant his tent in the camp of Dan. His mother was from the tribe of Dan. So he said, that's where I'm going to live. And they said to him, what are you doing here? Who are you to plant a tent in the camp of Dan? And he said, I'm from the daughters of Dan. And they said to him, the text says, it's according to your father's house. He goes to Moshe's court, makes his case, and he loses, because it's true. What's he supposed to do? He doesn't have a place. And so he blasphemes against God in his misery because he loses. So the point that I'm trying to show here is you have elements in Judaism, in this case, the patriarchal tribal identity, which can lead to people feeling like they are, in fact, being discriminated against based on race, let alone when you get into some of the mystics who talk about it's a whole other realm, the idea of spiritual genetics. I'm not even going there. And so here I wanted to stress not only the sources we brought in the beginning about being in the image of God, but something that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein stresses in source number 20. He points out that in the beginning of the book of Bamidbar, in the middle of a section that's talking about the Jews and how they're going to camp in the wilderness and they're going to travel from Sinai to the land of Israel, suddenly throws in a law called Gezel Hager. The law of Gezel Hager is what to do in the event that somebody steals from somebody who converted to Judaism, and that person who had converted to Judaism never married anybody Jewish, and therefore they don't have any heirs. This person stole. We want to now return the item they stole. But who is going to get the item if the person they stole from passed away and there are no heirs because they had converted? And so the Torah tells you what to do in such a case. Says Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I'll tell you why this story is stuck in the middle of the Jews' travels and their campments and all of that. He says in source 20, while Judaism sees the family and the nation as central to Jewish identity and consciousness, it is well aware of the danger to which these loyalties can lead when taken to an extreme. Okay, our focus on identity and family and all of that can be dangerous. It is for this reason that we are commanded with regard to Gezel Hager in the middle of Parshas Nasa. It is precisely the ger, the foreigner, lacking the sense of familial, tribal, and national roots who is most vulnerable to the atmosphere pervading the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, where we're talking all about who gets to live where and who their relatives are, and we get a census of all of the families from the different tribes. He says that's when you need to focus on it. Therefore, the Torah commands us here to deal with the ger exactly as we would with our fellow Israelites. The Torah is saying, I know there is within the system of Judaism the potential for people to take it and apply it in a way that harms people based on their lineage. And you have to make sure that you don't fall into that trap. That's the warning that we're seeing here, and I think it's a very important and powerful one. We're promised that in the future we will be unified, right? The beginning of Yeshaya, chapter 2, it's also brought in Micha, we are told that the nations are going to come to Yerushalayim, and they're going to want to study the Torah. I gave you source number 21 from the 19th chapter in Yeshaya. On that day, Israel will be a triad with Egypt and Assyria, blessing in the midst of the land as God has blessed it, saying, blessed is my nation Egypt, the work of my hand Assyria, my portion Israel. In the future, Hashem looks at all of these nations and says, they are my portion. All of them. They all gain that. And even before the time of Mashiach, source number 22, we're taught that on Rosh Hashanah, Hashem looks at every human being, one by one. All of us have a connection to Hashem. So it's very important that even as we remember, yes, as the Torah says in Devarim chapter 7, we have a restriction. Jews are supposed to marry members of the covenant. That is absolutely true. Nonetheless, we don't dare make the mistake of judging the material of a human being on the basis of their ancestry. I gave you review questions at the bottom. Hopefully you can get 4 for 4. We're going to be going into lunch. Hang on a minute. We're going to be going into lunch.